Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I would like to thank you all for hanging on. We've had we filled the hours, first and second hour, from the walls, the wall, to ceiling, to the floor, and now we're continuing to do so with my brother-in-arms, the Bitter Ender himself. I believe he's coming in, and we had a special request from my best friend since 1963. I didn't know he listened to the Confederate Hour as much as, but he did. And so I promised him that I would ask the Bitter Ender if Bitter Ender wanted to. It's strictly the Bitter Ender's. The third hour will always be Gene Andrews, the Bitter Ender's. It'll always be anything he wants. It's his thing. We don't interfere with that whatsoever. I said I would see if he would do some emphasis on General Nathan Bedford Forrest and some of the other Confederate generals. I've been knowing this guy since 1963. I had no idea that he had that much interest in the third hour. So anyway, with that, the Bitter Ender said he would. So I think that's what we're going to do. But to clarify, rather than me thinking what we're going to do, we're going to go to the professor himself. He will tell us what he's going to do. If he gets through,
thank you for that introduction, Eddie. I hope I can live up to it. You put a lot of pressure on me here. I may have to go lay down and sleep for a while and let somebody else do the first two segments, and then I'll come back.
Well, at least we don't have to buy any more swords today, because the Bitter Ender is hailing them damn swords, I'm telling you. But I'm all sure right. You always handle pressure well, like the pro that you are, Bitter Ender. So this hour is yours, Bitter Ender. God bless you, brother.
Okay. Thank you very much, Eddie. Well, yes, we tried to tie our Confederate history into the month that we're in. And I know last week we talked about the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July and the Battle at Gettysburg that was fought on those dates. And then today I would like to give us another date that's important in Confederate history, which is July 13th. And July 13th, which is tomorrow, of course, July 13th, 1821 was a very important date, not only in Tennessee history, but in Southern history and really military history of the world, as it turned out. July the 13th, 1821 was the birth date of future Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest. And he was born on that date to William and Miriam Beck Forrest in a little frontier town of Chapel Hill, Tennessee. Had a twin sister, Franny, but unfortunately the young lady died before she was a year old, which unfortunately was the way a lot of families were back then. If you had six or seven children, you were lucky if three of them or four of them made it to adulthood. They just didn't have all the immunizations that we have today and the medical science and things to keep them alive. But he survived and born, like we said, in Chapel Hill, Tennessee. And at that time, Chapel Hill was in Bedford County, and thus his middle name. Now it's Marshall County. They've taken part of Bedford County, part of Murray County, counties on either side of that, and created Marshall County in 1836. But his first name, Nathan, was for his grandfather, and then the second name, Bedford, was for the county he was in. And a lot of times we have tours of the Forrest home, and they ask me, said, well, was Bedford County named after Bedford Forrest? I said, no. It was the other way around. He was named after the county he was born in. His father, William, was a blacksmith, and he bought a farm and house that the house was built by the Mayfields in 1825 and moved his family out pretty much into the country from the little town of Chapel Hill and moved into this two-story house in 1830. He bought this house from the Mayfields in 1830 and 180 acres out there. And then his grandfather, Nathan, that he was named for, had gone down to northern Mississippi for the Chickasaw land purchase. They'd moved the Chickasaws out to what is today Oklahoma. It was the Indian nations back then. And he sent word back, there's a lot of cheap land down there for settlement, and it doesn't have all the rock like we have in some of the counties in Middle Tennessee. And people, when they come for a tour at the Forrest home, which is now in there, the boyhood home there in Marshall County, I just point to the rock wall and all the rock outcroppings around there and say, when they heard there was no rock down there in Mississippi, I think they were gone by sundown the next day. Get away from that place. So true enough, they moved down to northern Mississippi and set up farm life down there. Unfortunately for the family, Bedford Forrest's father died when he was 16 years old. And as a teenager at 16 years old, he was the oldest male in a family of a widowed mother and four other children. So he had to take over the duties of being father and provider and hunting for food and growing crops and taking care of the family at a very young age, teenage. There are a lot of things that happened to his life that would tend to, I guess, create a tougher and more hardened individual. There's the story about his mother that had gone down the road, had done some sewing for some neighbors, and they didn't have any money, so they paid her in chickens. And she had these chicken legs tied together and across the pommel of the saddle and was riding back at about sundown. And before she got back to their cabin, she heard a panther scream out in the woods. And she put the whip to the horse to get back to the cabin and almost made it. But the horse slowed down to go down a steep bank and across a creek, and that's when the panther made his spring and nailed her in the back with his claws, but he also hit the horse in the rear end. And when the horse felt these claws dig into his hide, he bolted and threw the panther off. But the panther did rip down her back, and you could imagine what it would feel like to have four or five razor blades just tearing down your back. And they got her off the horse and got her inside, and the only thing they had to clean it out with was turpentine. And it was a painful wound, but not fatal. So Bedford unleashed a pack of dogs to go after this panther and took a rifle with him. And it was nighttime now, and he couldn't keep up with the dogs, so he grabbed one of the dogs and cut a grapevine down and made a leash out of it. So he's following the dog. The dogs are following the panther. The dog's following the pack of dogs, and the pack of dogs are following the panther. Finally got this thing treed, and it's snarling up there and hissing, and the dogs are all around the bottom of this tree barking and yelping. So he didn't want to try to take a shot at night and maybe wound this thing and have it come down out of that tree and tear up the dogs and him too. So he goes a short distance away and sits down under a tree and waits for the sun to come up. And when he did, he got a good beat on this panther, fired one shot, killed it. It fell out of the tree, and he cut the ears off and took them back to his mother. So that was his teenage years. And I was giving a speech one time at one of the civic clubs and telling them that. They're all going, oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. I said, now, I don't know how many of y'all here in the audience today had a teenage life like that. I didn't. My biggest excitement was driving around Shoney's and trying to get a date with the girls who were Overton cheerleaders at my high school. That was about as exciting as my teenage life was. But tracking a panther at night was certainly something I never did.
And that wasn't part of mine either.
From the reaction, none of the people in the audience that day at that luncheon had done that either. So anyway, that was what he grew up in. And another thing that happened to him, he went into business with his uncle in Hernando, Mississippi. And his uncle had a feud with some people up the road there, the Matlock brothers. And one Saturday afternoon, Bedford and his uncle were walking down the main street in Hernando, and they met two of the Matlock brothers coming toward them and their overseer. And one of the Matlock brothers whipped out a pistol and shot his uncle dead right there in the street. Bedford pulls out a pistol, shot this one, the one that fired the shot and killed his uncle. The other Matlock brother started to reach for a pistol. Bedford turned his revolver on him, and it clicked and misfired. And somebody in the crowd was watching all this, and they threw him a Bowie knife. I guess Hernando, at that time, didn't have football on Saturday afternoon, so you'd go out and watch the shootouts in the street on Saturday afternoon instead of watching Ole Miss or Mississippi State or LSU or somebody. Go out in the street and watch the shootout. And so threw him a Bowie knife, and he went after this other Matlock brother with a Bowie knife and ran him off. And at this time, the overseer decided, you know, they're not paying me enough to take on this wild teenager, and he took off running too. And so Forrest was arrested and taken before the magistrate, and they said, no, that was self-defense. So he was released. Now, he did become before the war for Southern independence, by the time he was an adult, a very wealthy businessman. And he met a young lady, Marianne Montgomery, in a rather unusual way. He was out riding one day and came up on a creek. And there was a buggy stuck in the creek, and a black gentleman that was the driver was trying to get the buggy out of the creek. He got stuck in the mud. And over on the other side of the creek were two so-called gentlemen that were just sitting there watching this lady and her daughter stuck out in the middle of this thing and trying to get out. So we will come back after the break and tell you how the romance between Bedford Forrest and Marianne Montgomery began and continued.
Well, for one, I can't wait to hear that. Be right back, folks.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and, by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
In the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag.
Oh, that good old napalm. Ain't nothing like it. Cough, cough. It don't smell so good. Right back to you, Bitter Ender. I can't wait to hear that story about Nathan Bedford Forrest. Somehow, I just can't associate General Forrest, that devil Forrest, like I think it was, Sherman's, General Sherman said, he doesn't seem like the romantic type, but go ahead and dispel the myth.
Back up to the beginning of our story. We said we were going to talk about Nathan Bedford Forrest. His birthday is tomorrow, the 13th of July. And at one time, that was a holiday, state holiday in the state of Tennessee. All the state offices were closed and the banks. The post office was open. It wasn't a federal holiday, but that was a holiday in the state, as was Robert E. Lee's birthday on January 19th. And Jefferson Davis on the 3rd of June, we had all three of those Confederate heroes. It was a state holiday in Tennessee. But then when the federal government moved in and took over making Mondays national holidays, and they crammed that ML King Day down our throat, we got that. And then to make room for that, they got rid of Lee's birthday in January and then finally got rid of all of our Confederate heroes' holidays. So, now we're all just like good old U.S. of A. citizens, and all of our history and our monuments and everything are being taken away. So anyway, get back to happier times. We're talking about Bedford Forrest's romance with his future wife, Marianne Montgomery. They said he was out and found their carriage stuck in a creek in the mud, and they couldn't get it out. And so he unhitched his horse, waded out in there, and took her mother and carried her over to the bank, set her down, and then carried Mary Ann over to the bank, set her down, got the weight, some of the weight off the carriage, and went back with this black fella that was the driver, and put a pole underneath there and pried up the rear axle, and they got it out, and then helped the ladies get back in their carriage. And these two dandies, or you know, whatever they were, you know, hot shots that were sitting over there and watching this whole show, he chewed them out and told them to get out of there, and if they didn't get out in a hurry, he was going to throw them in the creek. So they took off. So he asked Mary Ann and her mother if he could come by and call on her the next day, and they said, well, certainly, young man, for what you did for us. So he did. He came by. And lo and behold, those two clowns that wouldn't help him yesterday were sitting around at the house. He just didn't do anything, waited in there, grabbed him by the collar and threw him off the porch and told him not to come back. And so a few weeks later, he asked Mary Ann for her hand in marriage and went to her father to ask. And he said, well, Bedford, you gamble, and you're a pretty rough character. I don't know if my daughter ought to marry you. She's a very refined lady. And he said, well, sir, that's why I want her to marry me. I think she'll make a much better man out of me. So, and so they were married. And the thing is, yeah, he did gamble, and he was a horse trader, and he had a lot of scrapes with other people and had a pretty bad temper. But he never smoked, never used tobacco in any form, and he never drank. And somebody asked him, said, well, I like the taste of alcohol too much. I can't drink. So he never did that. But anyway, growing up there, he eventually made a lot of money in real estate and livestock sales. He was a very good, very shrewd businessman, worked hard, didn't mind spending long hours. And by the time the war came along, in 1861, Bedford Forrest and his family, his wife and his children, he was worth over $1.5 million, which today would be about $45 to $55 million, which is a pretty well-off businessman. He was one of the richest men in the South. And now, one of the things that's always thrown against him, oh, yeah, but he was a slave dealer. Well, that's right, he was. But slavery was a legal profession. And you could have been worse than having been one of Mr. Forrest's slaves, because his slave quarters in Memphis always passed inspection by the Board of Health. He wasn't running a dump. He took care of the people that he was dealing with. He would never break up a family. He would not sell the man to one person and his wife to another person. And oftentimes he tried to buy back family members, either wives or children that had been separated from their husband and father. Because he was a businessman, and he felt if they were all together, they were less likely to run off. And there were certain people in the tri-state area of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Arkansas that he wouldn't sell to. He knew they were going to mistreat the slaves. So, but eventually he got out of the business. There was a certain stigma about being a slave dealer, and he didn't want that hanging over his children's head. He didn't care so much about himself. You know, he could defend himself, but he didn't want his children hung with that. And the situation was, people owned slaves back then because the John Deere tractor hadn't been invented, and slaves were the way to operate these huge farms. And the South crops like cotton, tobacco, and sugarcane were very, very labor-intensive. And so you needed a lot of people to harvest the crop and take care of it and sell it and get it bundled up and ready to go to market. So it wasn't that people disliked blacks. They needed a large number of people to do the farm operations. And originally in the colonies, they tried using white slaves from Scotland and Ireland and Wales, and bringing them over here to work in the southern colonies like South Carolina, Georgia, or in the tropics, the islands in the Caribbean. The whites just died like flies. They could not handle the tropical diseases like malaria, yellow fever, and the heat. And so they started using blacks because they'd grown up in Africa, and they were immune to those diseases that were killing the whites left and right. So it wasn't like they hated black people. It was the fact that black people could survive in a hot climate and whites couldn't. So that's why slavery came into the southern states as much as it did, because of the climate. And originally, slavery was legal in all 13 colonies, and slavery was legal in all 13 of the original states. So to point their finger at the South and say this was terrible and awful and horrible thing, the Yankees need to turn the finger around and point at themselves. And then one thing we've talked about before, there was never a slave ship that flew a Confederate flag or was chartered out of a Southern port. All the slave ships came from Boston, Philadelphia, New York, New Bedford, and the biggest slave trading port was Providence, Rhode Island. And a lot of these wealthy people that left these endowments to the Harvard and all the fancy Ivy League schools, these people made their money in the slave trade. And so then they gave money to Brown and Harvard and Yale and Princeton and all these colleges when they had a guilty conscience. So anyway, Forrest got out of that because of the stigma. It was okay to own slaves, but you shouldn't be a slave dealer. It's kind of like today. People want to own a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or Mercedes, but they really don't want to hang out with men that work on cars and have That's grease true. Under their fingernails. But driving a Mercedes, you know, or something like that, or a Ferrari, oh, that's okay, but we just don't want to hang out with the people that work on it because they couldn't come to dinner with us at the club or play nine holes on the club's golf course. So, you know, double standards are not a recent phenomenon. Okay, so the war clouds are spreading over the South. Forrest was against secession. And Tennessee had two referendums on secession. They had one referendum in February, right after the Confederate government was formed in Richmond, and it was voted down. But after Lincoln, the great dictator, called for an army to invade the South and force the seven seceded states at gunpoint to join the Union, then that's when states like Arkansas and Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, and later on Kentucky and Missouri passed the Ordinance of Secession. And it wasn't because the Confederate states, the northern or the upper Confederate states in the northern part of the South, were that big on slavery, the issue of slavery. The issue was Lincoln was raising an army to march through Tennessee and go into Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and force them at the point of a gun to be a part of the United States. And if the United States is such a great democracy and the shining light on the hill and the hope for the rest of the world, why yes. do they have to force people at the point of a gun to be a part of their country?
And I've asked that question. That's not polite to ask that question. Polite to ask that question.
Oh, I know. That's hate speech.
Yes.
And you know, I know the cops are going to be kicking the door down here in a few yeah. minutes. You hear a loud noise. They're coming through the front door. So anyway, after that, Tennessee had a second secession in referendum in June, and Tennessee voted to leave the Union. And Forrest, we don't know how he voted on the second one, but in the first one, he voted against it because he was a businessman. He thought secession was bad business-wise for the South. But after the second one, we do know that he, just like Robert E. Lee was against secession in Virginia. But like Robert E. Lee in Virginia, when his state, Tennessee, voted to leave the Union, he offered his service to the Confederacy. Just like when Virginia voted to leave the Union, Robert E. Lee offered his service to Virginia and then to the Confederate States government. So that's what Forrest did. And somebody with that much money and influence and the people he knew in the state would usually ask for a high rank in the army or a high political office. There was absolutely no snobbery in Forrest's character. He walked into the recruiting office and enlisted as a private in the Confederate States Army. And he was a 40-year-old private, which most people at 40 years old retire out of the military. And he was just starting out as a private. He was in Captain White's cavalry company in Memphis, which was his home. Well, he had a home there. He had various farm homes outside of Memphis. So I'm sure most of the teenagers in that outfit called him Pops or Grandpa or something like that. At 40 years old, they thought he was ancient. They didn't think he could get up on a horse, much less, you know, survive in combat. But
they found out differently.
They found out very differently. It wasn't long before...
Quick break, Gene.
Okay, I didn't hear the music. Sorry. We'll come back.
Be right.
The land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. news this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. A judge's order in California now temporarily halting some ICE crackdowns while a lawsuit moves forward. Here's Julie Walker with the story.
A federal judge Friday ordering the Trump administration to end indiscriminate immigration stops and arrests in California. The order also bars the federal government from restricting attorney access at a Los Angeles immigration detention facility. Immigrant advocacy groups filed the lawsuit last week, accusing President Trump's administration of systematically targeting brown-skinned people in Southern California during its ongoing immigration crackdown. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security says the allegations are disgusting and categorically false. I'm Julie Walker.
President Trump levying tariffs of 30% against the European Union and Mexico. Those start on August the 1st. The president says that Mexico has been helpful somewhat in stemming the flow of undocumented migrants and fentanyl into the United States. Also at townhall.com, President Trump has named an interim NASA chief. Here's correspondent Bernie Bennett with more.
NASA's under new management after an announcement from President Trump late Wednesday evening, naming current Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy as the agency's interim administrator. The announcement credits Duffy for doing, quote, a tremendous job in his role as Transportation Secretary, which it seems he will maintain as he also oversees the space agency. The appointment came on the eve of the Senate Appropriation Committee's scheduled markup of the White House's bill that allocates funds to NASA, which proposes a nearly 25% cut to the agency's overall budget and decimates funding for current and future science missions by almost 50%. Bernie Bennett in Washington.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
Summer is all about making great memories. Boy, I love getting out on the boat. I admit that one of my little joys in life is to get on a boat and ride around on Tampa Bay. But if you're living with pain, those future memories can be stolen from you. Here's a thought. Try Relief Factor. Let's see if we can get you out of pain. Relief Factor is a 100% drug-free daily supplement designed to help your body fight pain. It's a doctor-developed formula made of natural ingredients. The best part of all, Relief Factor never masks the pain. It helps reduce or even eliminate it for good. Whether it's doing what I do, whether it's kayaking on a lake, running around with the little ones, or just chilling in the hammock with a good book, Relief Factor can help you feel better, move better, and do more of the things you love all summer long. So if you're ready to reclaim your summer and make some amazing memories, head over to ReliefFactor.com or give them a call at 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. Do it now and get their 3-week quick start for just $19.95. That number again, 1-800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. Fight pain naturally with Relief Factor.
I'm Michael Hill, President of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C. and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpicTimes.com.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Dear Blood Group Radio family, I only wish you could hear some of the conversations that me and the Bitter Ender have during the breaks, but we can't do that today. We got to go right back to the big event. And the Bitter Ender is going to take us right back there. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Our biography of Nathan Bedford Forrest, future Lieutenant General in the Confederate States Army. And here's another thing. He enlisted as a private, and by the end of the war, he'd risen to the rank of Lieutenant General, which is the highest rank you could get. And there were only two people in U.S. military service that did that on the ground forces. And I've heard some naval people rose higher or did that in the naval equivalent of private up to Lieutenant General, whatever the ranks were in the Navy. But there were two on-land military people, Bedford Forrest and General Lewis B. Puller in the Marine Corps, Chesty Puller. Had pulled that out, started up as a private and wound up as a lieutenant general. So Forrest enlisted as a private. We were laughing about how those teenagers in that cavalry company probably called him Pops and Grandpa since he was 40 years old. But it didn't last long. He knew Governor Isom G. Harris, the governor of Tennessee, and Governor Harris knew him and from his business dealings and all. And Forrest was an alderman in the city of Memphis City Council. And so Governor Harris gave him a commission as a lieutenant colonel and asked him to raise a mounted cavalry battalion at his own expense, of course, because the Confederate government didn't have the money for saddles, rifles, cavalry equipment, or horses. So Forrest did that, and he went with some of his men up to Louisville, Kentucky, and they were dressed up as old beat-up, run-down, worn-out farmers and old rickety wagon and potato sacks. Bought all his armaments, rifles, pistols, cavalry tack for the horses, whatever they needed, loaded up the wagons, and they knew that the federal soldiers were looking for them coming south out of Louisville and headed down to the Confederate Army at Bowling Green, Kentucky. So what they did, they left Louisville and headed up the road towards Cincinnati, going northeast. And then when they figured they'd gotten far enough away from the federal picket lines, they swung around, made a big loop around Louisville, and headed south and got all their equipment back and mounted up his troops, and he was ready to go. Fought his first battle at Sacramento, Kentucky in December of 1861, and then the next big battle he was in, it was at Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River in February of 1862. Grant and his fleet of gunboats had come down the Tennessee River, and they pretty much, the fort at Fort Henry on the Tennessee River was flooded out. Some of the brilliant Confederate engineers built it down too close to the waterline, and when the winter rains came and the river rose, they were flooded out. And a lot of the locals said, look up in that tree, and you see all those dead limbs and things up there in that tree? That's how high the river's going to get when it floods. And they said, oh, no, this is the way we did it at West Point. We know how to do this. Well, most of the fort was flooded out, and Grant never got a chance to attack the fort. He disembarked his men downriver from the fort, and by the time they waded through mud and water and backwater and everything, the battle at Fort Henry was already over, and the Confederates had evacuated, and they were headed over that little, they called it land between the rivers. It's land between the lakes now. To reinforce Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River at Dover, Tennessee. So Forrest then went after Grant, trying to make it across there, harassing his men, cutting down trees, blocking the road. And it took Grant several days to just go over that small neck of land between the two rivers to get to Fort Donelson. So the Confederates decided that they did not want to be surrounded and trapped in a fort and be starved out of there. So on February 14th, they decided to launch a surprise attack at dawn against Grant's army and get away on the open road between Dover, Tennessee and Clarksville, Tennessee, and then on to Nashville. And that morning, the 14th, they gave Grant's army a real unusual Valentine's gift. They launched an attack against the federal army, and Forrest was out on the flank, and he was capturing artillery and prisoners and equipment. And now the road was open to Clarksville. They could get out of there. But they had a second choice, and this is what Forrest was trying to convince them to do. Take everybody you had, throw them into the attack. We've already got Grant's lines bent back into a sharp V. Throw everybody we have into the attack and drive him and his army right over the bluff and into the Cumberland River. But the West Point brilliant generals that we had commanding at Fort Donelson came up with a third option. They turned around and marched back into the fort. And then that night, they're talking about surrendering. And Forrest, they called Forrest in not because they wanted his opinion. I mean, good night. He wasn't a military man. He was just a volunteer. And see, Forrest never went to West Point or VMI or the Citadel. He just had a ton of common sense and tremendous energy on the battlefield. But yet his tactics today are studied in military schools all over the world, and he never spent a day in a military school. He just had a wealth of common sense and determination. So they called him in, not because they wanted his opinion. They just told him, well, you're in charge of the cavalry, but we're going to surrender the fort. And he goes, what? He said, our scouts have been out. The road's open. And they said, no, we've seen campfires out there. And the Federal Army has retaken their lines. We can't get out. And he said, no. He sent his scouts out again, and they came back about 3 a.m. and said, no, the campfires are where wounded Federal soldiers were laying out on the ground and freezing to death, and they threw leaves and sticks and junk on the old campfires just to try to keep from freezing. And Forrest said, we're going out of here. And they said, all right, we'll be gone by noon, by daylight, because we're going to surrender. And he said, I didn't bring my men here to surrender. We're going out of here tonight, even if we have to bust hell wide open. And that's a great title of a book. Dr. Samuel Mitchum wrote a book about Forrest called Bust Hell Wide Open. And they did. They rode out. He took his 600 men and his cavalry battalion and about 200 or 300 infantry that climbed up behind them and rode double and got out of there. And when they were going past Dover, Tennessee, they came up on Lick Creek and the column stopped. And he rode up to the front and said, why did you stop? And one of the soldiers said, well, sir, the creek's frozen. We don't know how deep it is. And Forrest said, well, we'll find out. And he put the spurs to his horse and jumped his horse off the bank. The horse hit the ice, went into the water, and the water only came up to about the saddle skirts. He rode on across and said, all right, let's go get the column moving. And that was Forrest.
Yeah.
He would not ask his enlisted men to do something that he wasn't willing to do himself. And that's why he had so much admiration from the troops that he was commanding. And they were scared of him. If they screwed up, he was going to cuss them out and grab them and throw them back into the line of battle. One time in one of the battles, it was going hot and heavy, and he was riding up the road encouraging this unit and encouraging that unit to hang on and do this and do that. He saw one of his soldiers running to the rear, and Forrest jumps off his horse, grabs this guy, clubs him with a pistol, and knocks him into a ditch and said, why are you running? And he goes, well, sir, I'm afraid I'm going to be killed. And Forrest said, well, you're going back in the line of battle, and you're right, you might be killed, but gee damn you, if you run away again, I guarantee you I'll kill you. So he threw him back into the line. But then Forrest was right there with him, you know, and he never would ask his men to do something that he wouldn't do. And he led from the front, which was very costly. He was shot 5 times during the war. And he carried 2 bullets the rest of his life. They were so close to his spine that the doctors were afraid if they tried to dig him out, or it may either paralyze him or kill him. And so these are big 58 caliber bullets, like the end of your finger, being lodged in close to your spine. So anyway, he then fought in a lot of the major battles in the Western Theater, at Shiloh, at Chickamauga. He went on raids against the Federal Army. And here's an interesting thing about Forrest. He stopped all 4 of the Federal Army commanders that were in the Western Theater of the War, the Western Theater being from the Appalachian Mountains all the way over to the Mississippi River. He stopped Grant, he stopped Sherman, he stopped Rosecrans, and he stopped Buell. And those were the 4 Yankee commanding officers for the Army that was fighting against the Army of Tennessee in the Western Theater of the War. He never fought a single one of them head-to-head. They outnumbered him about 10 or 20 to 1. He just swung around behind them, cut their supply lines, and they had no supplies, no medical supplies, no food, no ammunition other than what they were carrying, no feed for the horses, forage for the horses and the mules. They had to turn around and go back. July of 1862, on his 41st birthday, he swung around Buell's Union Army that was marching on Chattanooga. Forrest swings around behind him, captures the town of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, tears up railroad track, cuts telegraph lines, captured 2 Yankee camps there in town, 2 regiments on the northwest side of town, the northeast side of town, and they got in there that morning and got prisoners out of the jail in Murfreesboro. He was going to stop in Woodbury, which was just a few miles away over in Cannon County, in Murfreesboro and Rutherford County. The women came out and asked him if he could do something. The Yankees had come through that day, and they took their husbands. And they were going to execute them the next morning in Murfreesboro because they'd been supplying food and horses to their sons who were in the Confederate Army. So the Yankees had taken the men out of Woodbury, taken them over to Murfreesboro, going to execute them. Horse men rode all night, and we'll tell you what happened, the battle at Murfreesboro on July 13th, 1862.
Well, I hope our audience, our families enjoy this story as much as I am. A true story as much as I am. Be right back, folks.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
Hey, this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Well, dear Blood River Radio family members, we've got the Bitter Ender and the Lightning Bug King, King of the Lightning Bugs in the theater. We need to tell that story.
No, I didn't do that. Some of my friends did that. I wouldn't do something like that.
Well, I don't know, Bitter Ender. Anyway, that was one hell of a story. I wish our people could hear what goes on during the breaks. Anyway,
well,
back to you, Bitter Ender.
Through with our last segment here. I got a couple of things I need to cover right quick. A couple of battles that Parris fought in. One was at Bryce's Crossroads in northern Mississippi in June of 1864. And there was an army of over 8,000 sent out from Memphis. And you were given the quote from Sherman earlier that and what he said about Forrest was that devil Forrest must be hunted down and killed or captured if it costs 10,000 lives and bankrupts the treasury. And the reason Sherman was so afraid of Forrest was loose there in northern Mississippi. He was afraid Forrest was going to get out of Mississippi, come into Tennessee, and cut the Nashville and Decatur Railroad. And Sherman was campaigning against Atlanta. And if he cut that railroad and the Nashville-Chattanooga Railroad, Sherman was stuck in North Georgia with no supplies. And they couldn't use the Tennessee River in the summertime because of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. They couldn't get big boats up over the shoals there. So once, if Forrest took out the railroads, Sherman was up the proverbial creek with no way, and Joe Johnston, the Army of Tennessee, sitting right square in front of him. So they would send four different armies out of Memphis in that spring and summer to try to destroy Forrest. And he either defeated them or caused them to withdraw back to Memphis, but the Yankee strategy worked. He didn't get out of Mississippi until September of 1864, and then he did take out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad. By then it was too late, though. Atlanta had already fallen, and Sherman was headed off towards his march to the sea in Savannah. But one of the battles was at Bryce's Crossroads. General Sturgis, the Union general, had over 8,000 men, 22 pieces of artillery, and 250 wagons that he was going across Mississippi, stealing all the food and supplies he could get. Forrest men met him with only 3,000 men at Bryce's Crossroads in an all-day battle. He routed Sturgis's army off the field and began a route and a race, really, back to Memphis to get away from Forrest. Forrest captured 20 of the 22 pieces of artillery and all 250 of their wagons. And Sturgis came up with one of the greatest quotes of the war. That night, some of his officers were urging him, "Well, General, we need to make a stand. We need to make a stand somewhere. We need to make a stand." And Sturgis told him, no. If Mr. Forrest, not General Forrest, but Mr. Forrest, if Mr. Forrest will just leave me alone, I will leave him alone. And Forrest wasn't about to leave him alone. He was on him like a bulldog, just picking up prisoners, wagons, abandoned artillery all the way back toward Memphis. And that battle was called by military historians the perfect battle, where 3,000 could defeat over 8,000, and the tactics that Forrest used, the woods and constant pressure on the Union Army to turn the tide in his favor. And he was up and down the line, just like he always was, encouraging his men in one instance, cussing them out in another place on the battlefield, and keeping the pressure on the Federal Army till finally the line broke. One other thing I wanted to talk about. Back it up a little bit to April of 1864. Forrest was on a raid into West Tennessee for horses. He'd been assigned two cavalry divisions, and this was the third command that he had to raise during the war. This first command, they took it away from him, gave it to Joe Wheeler. His second command, they did the same thing. And by the time he got the troops trained and they were a lethal fighting force, they took them away and gave them to somebody else. So this was the third command he had to raise during the war. He had Abraham Buford's dismounted cavalry division, which are just infantry, and then James Chalmers' cavalry. They went on a raid into West Tennessee for horses and up into Kentucky. They left Columbus, Mississippi on March the 1st, 1864. Nothing in the operational orders that they had said anything about Fort Pillow, which was over on the Mississippi River, and on the Tennessee side of the river, and Arkansas on the other side of the river. So they went up through West Tennessee, captured Union City. Part of his men went up to Mayfield and all the way up to Paducah, Kentucky, and got more horses. The Confederates burned cotton on the dock in Paducah, and it was Southern cotton that the Yankees had stolen from Southern farmers, and then these speculators and private business operators and hangers-on went with the Union Army, and behind lines, when it was good and safe, they would take whatever they could from the Southerners. And they had all this cotton piled up, and a lot of the really wealth that came from the North during the war came from items that were stolen from the South. So when they burned that cotton, the Yankee speculators lost all their money that they had invested in that cotton. So they turned around, they got horses, Buford's division was remounted. They're coming out of the state. They're down at Trenton, Tennessee on April the 4th. Now, this raid's been going on for 5 weeks. On April the 4th, he sends a letter to his commanding officer in Mississippi, Stephen D. Lee, tells him what all they've captured, where all they've been, how many miles of railroad track they've torn up. Once again, for 5 weeks, nothing was said about Fort Pillow. And then on April the 6th, he sent a supplementary order and said, "We will attend to Fort Pillow." So what happened in 2 days? Well, the civilians of West Tennessee came to Forrest and said, "Can you please do something about this hellhole that they have over there on the Mississippi River?" The Yankee soldiers, black and white, were coming out of Fort Pillow and robbing and attacking the civilians in West Tennessee, especially going after the women. And that's one thing you didn't do. Forrest believed you fought men against men, but when you went after women, that crossed the line. So he rode his troops over there during the night at dawn on April the 12th. They overran the pickets, drove the Federal soldiers back into the earthworks that they'd built on the bluff over the river there, and the Confederates were up on this ridge that was parallel to this circular fort there that's backed up to the river. They were shooting down into the fort. So any Yankee that raised his head up above that earthen wall of the fort was nailed. Forrest sent in three, not one, not two, but three demands for surrender, and they were all turned down. And so late that afternoon at 3:30, He ordered the third request for surrender was turned down. He ordered a charge. The Confederates came over the wall. The Yankees broke and ran for the river, stumbled, fell, tumbled down this bluff to the river road down below where the fort was. Now the Confederates were closing from the down the river road from the north to the south, the south to the north, and the ones that had come over the wall were up on top of this bluff shooting down on them. And they claimed, after all this was over, the northern press made up this story about the massacre at Fort Pillow. And they repeat that garbage today. When they talk about Forrest, they talk about the massacre at Fort Pillow. That's all they can talk about. Number one, it wasn't a massacre. Not by definition. The massacre means you wiped out everybody. They took out 201 prisoners. They left 130 wounded federal soldiers behind because they were too seriously wounded to be moved, and they left them with the federal medical staff that night. So if it was a massacre, he didn't do a very good job. But it was war propaganda. And like we said before, fake news is not a recent phenomenon. The other thing they throw against Forrest occurred after the war. They claim that Forrest started the Ku Klux Klan, which is another lie from CNN and Yankee propagandists and historians and so-called experts. Forrest, after the war, went home to Memphis. In December of 1865, the Klan was started in a little town south of Nashville, Pulaski, Tennessee. But it didn't start as a political organization. It was a soldiers' organization, kind of like the American Legion, VFW, something like that. And they get all mad when I say that, and I said, no, you're not listening. The original Klan. And there were six Confederate soldiers that started it, and their names used to be on a plaque on the wall of a law office in Pulaski, Tennessee, where this meeting first took place. And Forrest's name is not on that plaque or not on that list. And it had no political objective at all. They just went around in these costumes, and they were telling everybody they were ghosts from the Battle of Shiloh, and everybody knew it was a big joke, until the Reconstruction got so bad. And then that's when it turned from a joke and a fraternity into a political organization. But Forrest never started it. Probably he, like most white men in the South, had to join it to protect his family. And the reason Klan got the reputation of a anti-black, organization like that was because the federal government was so rotten in the Reconstruction government that they forced on the South. And they passed the Franchise Act, where any Southerner that served in the Confederate Army or even aided the Confederate Army, if you had a feud with one of your neighbors and they wanted to get back at you, they could say, well, I've seen that old Eddie Miller. He sold a bag of corn to Forrest Cavalry when they come through here during the war. Then you were taken off the voting rolls. You couldn't vote. So you couldn't vote for sheriff. You couldn't vote for tax assessor. You couldn't vote for judges. And the South were just pretty much white slaves in their own country and for 12 years after the war. And it wasn't just the Klan. There were vigilante groups all over the South that sprang up to protect the people. The armies were disarmed. We had no army to defend us anymore. And so they had to do something to protect themselves, especially protect the women. So that's what Forrest was probably in. But he wasn't the founder, and more than likely wasn't the head of it. He died at the age of 56 in 1877 in Memphis. They said about 20,000 people were in the funeral procession. He was that well thought of, and about 3,000 of them were black. And if he was such an evil person, why'd all these blacks show up for his funeral? Buried in Memphis and been reburied at Columbia, Tennessee, at Sons of Confederate Veterans National Headquarters. I hope our listeners enjoyed the little biography sketch of Nathan Bedford Forrest, July 13th, 1821.
I have no doubt, Gene, if they did enjoy it. I know I certainly did, and I'll just add, I'll never, ever forget that horrible night when they took the body of General Nathan Bedford Forrest in the dead of night, in a rainstorm, in the winter. It was the most dishonorable act I've ever seen, and I know we're running out of time, but God bless you, Bitter Ender, for coming on. Thank you so much, and thank you, Little Lizzie, for running the Flawless Board. Thank you, Blood River Radio family. Same time, same place next week, the 19th of July. We'll be back, God willing. Good night, everybody.